You are listening to the Mid-Current Church Podcast. Today's message is week one of our sermon series. Let's talk about it. Exploring the top four objections to Christianity. For more information and to visit us online, check out midcurrentchurch.org and find us on Facebook and Instagram. And now, here is Pastor Sten Carlson with today's message.
Every now and again, I experience a moment in life that I know fairly instantly will make for a fitting story up here on Sunday morning. And my family experienced one of those at my expense not long ago. Erica and I, truthfully, we have been growing more and more frustrated at times with our kids who are always hovering around the dinner table, picking food off their plate in the moments before dinner was actually served. And we are trying to be intentional about, setting some dinner time expectations and teaching our kids good manners, that we wait to eat before, dinner is served. We wait to eat the food on our plates until everyone is sitting, sit it down at the table till dinner is served, till we've had a chance to pray together as a family. But nothing was really seeming to get that message across. And so every evening it was like the same infuriating ordeal. The kids like begging for something to eat, sneaking up and, picking food off their plates and, or telling on each other that someone was taking a bite while we were praying or some other kind of whole ordeal like this. And Eric and I couldn't take it any longer. We were so tired of every night, same thing. We're so tired of like, no, not yet. Can you please wait? Put your food down. Dinner's not ready. We'll call you. It's the same thing over and over again. We're like, oh my goodness, I cannot handle this any longer. And so just a couple weeks ago, Erica, same deal, where she's setting the dinner table, she's dishing out all the food onto the plates, and I was standing over the oven with my back to everything that was happening behind us, and I was taking some potatoes out of the oven, and you could say that sometimes I have been known to do just a little taste testing in these situations. And so you might see where this is direction this is heading here, okay? So Erica she's at the table, my back's to the whole thing. I can just hear everything happening behind me. Erica's at the table, she's fending off the kids, all the usual stuff, the begging and the whining and the picking, and she's shooing them away and she's pleading with them to stop and to wait until it was actually dinner time. And finally, the commotion behind me, it was too much for me to handle, and I knew Erica needed some backup. And so I spun around, and in the most stern and firm dad voice I had, I said, look, here's the rule. Our family does not eat food until it's dinner time. And they all froze. The problem that failed to register for me in the moment is that as I spun around, I not only had a forkful, I'm not kidding you, ask my wife. I not only had a forkful, but also a mouthful of potatoes when I declared this unbreakable, unforgivable, ironclad Carlson family dinner time rule that we don't eat before it's dinner time. And all three of the kids and Erica looked back at me with this blank stare of confusion and intrigue. And almost in unison, they all lifted a finger and began to point at me, pointing out the fact that at that very moment, I was doing the very thing that I had just scolded everyone for. I paused for a second long enough I'll pause long enough to realize what I had just done. I hung my head in defeat, and we all had a pretty good laugh at my expense. In that moment, even I knew that I was guilty of becoming what most people would describe as a hypocrite. Now, my family, they had a lot of grace for me in that moment, which I appreciate. We did have a good laugh when I realized, oh my gosh, I'm an idiot, okay? They had a lot of grace for me in that moment, which I'm very grateful for. But the reality is, folks, the world today is not as gracious as my wife and kids. The world today is not as gracious in the face of what they might consider to be hypocrisy. In fact, there was a recent Barna Group study. The Barna Group does, you know, huge, you know, research projects, oftentimes in kind of the religious worlds. And so there was a recent Barna Group study that found that the top reason that people of no faith tradition today object to, or the top reason that they have doubts about Christianity, is because of their concern that Christians are hypocrites. It's the number one reason on this 2023 survey that they conducted. And so that is what I want to begin to explore today in the very first week of our new series that PJ introduced. The series is called Let's Talk About It. Over the course of this next month of April, we're going to look at the top four objections that the Barna study found. We're going to look at the top four objections that people had in this survey, the top four objections that people had about Christianity. And as I read over the list of concerns, they all made sense to some degree. And as I looked over the list, I thought to myself, these are great questions. I thought to myself, there's no reason that we as Christians need to ignore this list of questions. I said to myself, let's just talk about it. Right? These are concerns that I don't think that we need to be afraid to discuss as Christians. And so that's the plan for the month of April. I decided, let's just talk about it. And as we kick off here, I have to admit that I was incredibly fascinated to learn that this Barna study, this survey they conducted, they found that 42%, this is almost half, almost one out of every two people that they interviewed, 42% had doubts about Christianity because of the hypocrisy that they claimed that they saw in you know, people who were claiming to be religious, claiming to follow Jesus or to, you know, to be Christians. 42% said, I got major questions because of the hypocrisy I see in people who claim to be religious in whatever nature. Now, it makes sense to me. It makes sense to me that people in the world today would have their radar up for hypocrisy, because the reality is Jesus had his radar up in the world 2,000 years ago for the very, very, very same thing. And he actually had some pretty sharp words for the people that he found to be in this category. And so I want to look at a few of those moments just to get a sense that, yes, this was a thing that Jesus indeed was concerned about. And so here's one of those instances from the New Testament book of Matthew, chapter 23. Matthew is just one of Jesus's disciples who followed Jesus closely and recorded the things that he saw and that he experienced along the way. And at one moment, Jesus is kind of like going head to head with a group of religious teachers and leaders known as Pharisees. And here's what he says to them. It's one of actually a long list of similar accusations that he makes. But here's what he says. He says to these people, he says, "You hypocrites, listen to this, for you are like whitewashed tombs." Let that image sink in for a second. He says, you're like whitewashed tombs, beautiful on the outside, but filled on the inside with dead people's bones and all sorts of impurity. He's saying, hey, there's a big difference, gang, between how the outside appears and what's really true of you on the inside, okay? He's very clearly not in favor of this kind of hypocritical behavior. But I want us to dig a little deeper to determine what precisely he's not in favor of. Because if I'm being honest, I'm not sure it's totally what we think it is. I'm not sure if we have the fullest sense or the firmest grasp on what it is that Jesus was actually getting at in moments like this. You see, I hear all the time. I hear about and I even participate in conversations all the time with people both inside and outside of the church who are concerned about Christians being hypocrites. And the concern usually revolves around the fact that Christians aren't perfect. Right? So someone, whether they're in the church or out of the church, whether they call themselves a Christian or not, right? People see a group of Christians aspiring to live a certain way, desiring to live according to a certain set of ideals or standards and intending to do their best to follow a particularly marked path. And then when people are watching, and if they should ever see that person who says they're a Christian, if they see that person ever stray from the path that they set out to follow, the assumption is then, if they have taken one step off of the path for a moment, the assumption is they have forfeited their right to ever acknowledge that someone else has perhaps strayed from that path as well, lest they be considered a hypocrite. And so that's the assumption. Christians are hypocrites. They said, this is the path I'm trying to walk, follow. But one time I saw they misstepped, right? That's the assumption. And here's the deal. No one wants to be a hypocrite. And so in order not to be a hypocrite, as it's defined today in the court of public opinion, there's really only two options. Number one, perfect the standard, meaning don't ever make a mistake. Or number two, erase the standard completely because nobody's perfect, right? This appears, just in the way that things work in the world today, this appears like the only two choices. Perfect the standard, that's impossible, or erase the standard. And I don't think that they are doing, either of these two options, I don't think they're doing anybody any good, nor do I think, maybe most significant to our conversation today, nor do I think that this kind of thinking, nor do I think it actually addresses what Jesus is actually concerned about. Acknowledging someone's imperfection while also being imperfect does not inherently, stay with me here, okay? Acknowledging someone's imperfection while also being imperfect, it doesn't inherently make one a hypocrite according to Jesus. Jesus isn't intending to say that Christians can't hold people accountable to a standard. In fact, listen to yet another moment that one of Jesus's other disciples, Luke, wrote about. Jesus is teaching about many things to a crowd of people who came to see him and to hear him speak. And at one point, Jesus says this. He says, "And why worry about a speck in your friend's eye when you have a log in your own eye? How can you think of saying, 'Friend, let me help you get rid of that speck in your eye,' when you can't see past the log in your own eye?" Hypocrite. Okay, but we have to notice something. He doesn't stop there. Look at what he says. He says, first, he doesn't end the conversation there. He doesn't say, "You hypocrite, you saw the speck." No, he says, first, get rid of the log in your own eye, then you will see well enough to deal with the speck in your friend's eye. Pay careful attention to this. The hypocrisy that Jesus is calling out, it's not simply the act of seeing the speck. You saw it, you hypocrite. You're not perfect either, right? The hypocrisy was not the act of noticing the speck in your neighbor. An imperfect person does not become a hypocrite the moment they notice the imperfection of someone else. The hypocrite is the one, according to Jesus's teaching here, the hypocrite is the one who hasn't dealt with their own stuff first. But when they do, then the assumption, maybe I would even say as strongly as the expectation that Jesus is alluding to, is that yes, in that area of their life that they have dealt with the stuff, the expectation is almost that they would reach back down the line to help someone, help someone else along. And so all of a sudden, we start to see here that Jesus hasn't necessarily taught that we're never to hold someone accountable to a standard. Rather, the way we hold someone accountable within a community is to make sure we pay attention to our own stuff first, our own faults first, and then, first us, then others, then we can turn to the missteps, to the faults of others with loving accountability. That's what he's saying. And in my estimation, this is when our definition, kind of in the court of public opinion today, I think this is when our definition of hypocrisy starts to unravel just a little bit. And a closer look, right, at all of the times that Jesus referred to hypocrites in the four books we refer to as the gospel, they will begin to reveal something slightly different, something that Jesus really is getting at. In fact, if you do a word study, which my bookshelf is full of books that help do word studies and definitions of the words used in the gospels, if you do a word study of all of the ways and all the times that Jesus uses the word hypocrite in the New Testament, which is often directed at these teachers of the religious law. If you look at all these times, you'll see the pattern when you see how it's used and what he's getting at and what the context was. You'll see that Jesus's greater concern in these moments was about deceit, malice, and even at times evil, not imperfection. His concern when calling people hypocrites was about malice and evil, and deceit, not imperfection. The people that Jesus calls hypocrite were not just guilty of, making a few mistakes. What he's calling out is the fact that they were actually abandoning God's intentions, God's, will, his word, by twisting the laws to fulfill their own purposes, their own agendas. And we get a glimpse of this kind of angle if we look at Mark chapter 7. Jesus' disciple Mark recorded yet another interaction that Jesus had with these same Pharisees, and they're calling out Jesus and his disciples for not following the letter of the law to the T. And so they're going back and forth, and here's what Jesus says to them. Once again, he says, "You hypocrites." And then he refers to Old Testament scriptures. He says, "Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you, for he wrote, 'These people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. Their worship is a farce, for they teach man-made ideas as commands for God.'" And then he says to the people, "For you ignore God's law and you substitute your own tradition." Right? The people he's calling hypocrites were not just people that made a few mistakes. They were completely abandoning God's intentions for their own purposes, for their own agenda. All too often, these religious leaders, they came to Jesus under false pretenses. They came flattering him or giving him the impression that they actually sought a genuine response from him on a certain matter, when really they were only trying to trap him and to take him down a few pegs so that they could rise up a few pegs. And that is what Jesus is calling hypocritical, okay? The most infamous hypocrites that Jesus challenged publicly were those that tried to cloak the evil within them with a show of external piety, external holiness. And so this is what we have to understand, gang. The sin, it's a big, scary word, right? But the sin of hypocrisy, it's not that we all have a few more bad marks than it would appear. That's true of all of us, gang. That's true of me, right? Believe it or not, I am far more imperfect than many of you would believe on your own or like to believe, right? That the sin of hypocrisy is not that we've messed up more than it would appear. The sin of hypocrisy, as Jesus is getting at, it's using the appearance of good as a disguise for what is not good and what is not right and what is not true or honorable or worthy of praise. It's believing, even if you take it a step further, it's believing, being convinced that who others think you are is actually more important than who God knows you to really be. And so when Jesus calls people hypocrites, he wasn't coming down on those who were trying but failing. He wasn't scolding decent, everyday people who were trying to follow Jesus, saying, "I hope to, but I didn't." He's not shaking his finger at people who are going like, I wanted to, I was trying to, but I just messed up. Jesus wasn't publicly challenging Christians who struggled with sin, but were fighting temptation and who kept on trying to do what is right, even on the hardest of days. That's not who he was calling a hypocrite. The real hypocrite in Jesus' teaching is the one who uses public virtue to cover private vice. We have to understand this. I know it can be confusing, right? Jesus isn't calling out the people who are just doing their best every day to follow Jesus but weren't doing it perfectly. He's calling people hypocrites who are using public virtue to cover private vice. Intentionally trying to present themselves one way in order to cover up what was really true, what was really true of their heart and their intentions and their agenda. And gang, I'm not sure that is what is true of most Christians. I'm not sure the average, everyday Jesus follower is walking around trying to create some smokescreen to get their own way. Now, I'll be very honest with you. There's no way I can prove that 100%. I'll be even more honest. I'm not saying that those kinds of Christians don't exist in some places in the world today. I'm not naive. All that I am saying is that I don't think that the majority of Christians are intentionally, methodically, trying to cover private vice with public virtue, okay? At least these aren't the Jesus followers that I meet day in and day out. These are not the Jesus followers who I work with. These are not my colleagues, right? I'm not saying these Christians don't exist. I'm just saying I'm not sure this is true of the majority. It's not true of the people that I tried to associate with. And so here's what concerns me about this question today. Here's what concerns me. In so many categories in the world today, it seems all too often that the majority of a particular people group are often defined by a minority of the people in that group, right? That the core of a people are all too often defined by the people on the fringes or on the far extremes, right? Take politics, for example, okay? The loudest voices, the loudest noises today, they come from the far left and the far right, right? That's who the news covers. Those are the two groups that are lobbing grenades over the head of everybody in the middle, right? And so we often judge people who vote differently than us, by the people on the far extremes of their party, right? When the reality is that most Americans sit somewhere closer to the center, you're watching the grenades fly overhead from one side to the next. And so here's what happened. People who maybe sit to the right of center, they get judged by all the crazies out on the far right. And then those who sit just to the left of center, they get judged and defined by all the crazies out on the far left, right? The many near the middle are often defined by just a few out on the fringes, okay? Let me try another example just in case politics is too sore a subject, okay? Think of sports. Okay, whole cities and whole fan bases are often defined by and judged by their worst representatives. A classic example of this, it comes from Philadelphia. A few years ago, the Vikings were playing a playoff game in Philadelphia against the Eagles, and I hate to burst anyone's bubble, but I am a Vikings fan. So this was a big deal. Playoff, Vikings at Eagles. Vikings lost, which is a heartbreaker, but here's the deal. I heard so many stories from that game in particular, of how awful Eagles fans were. The yelling, the screaming, this was when the stories came out about Eagles fans throwing batteries at people, and I heard so many Vikings fans were just like legitimately scared in those moments. And ever since that day, I'm not making this up, ever since that day, at least in my little world, the consensus among Vikings fans still today is that Eagles fans, they're all just horrible. Every person in Philadelphia, they're the worst. Now, I'm not saying I don't believe that all that happened. I mean, I read the reports. I'm not saying that it wasn't bad. It was bad. And I could be wrong. I don't know. But the reality in my mind, I've got to think that the stadium that day was probably filled with thousands of decent men and women. Kind-hearted moms and dad who brought their kids out to the game, who were probably disgusted at the behavior that they saw from fellow fans, right? But no one thinks about that. The truth is, based on what we saw, all Eagles fans, everyone in the city of Philadelphia is the worst. Eagles fans are the worst, right? And what's funny is I've heard the similar stories about Vikings fans. I was talking with a friend not long ago who, I mean, he was very serious. He said, I cannot stand Vikings fans. He thinks they are the worst. And it all stems, he was honest, it all stems from the one time that he had went to a Vikings game. And he had a run-in with some rude and probably drunk Vikings fan. And that's all that it took for him to determine that all Vikings fans are jerks. He said, I can't stand them. I can't stand Minnesota fans. Gang, once again, the many are all too often defined by the few. And I just think sometimes the very same thing is happening with Christianity, right? The majority of Jesus followers trying to faithfully follow Jesus, the majority of Christianity is sadly defined by a small minority of Christians, right? That were highlighted, you know, in the news or whose just unthinkable behavior went viral online. Right? And these are people who I would argue are not at the heart of the movement, at least not the one that I'm advocating for or want to be associated with. And meanwhile, the millions of Christians all over the planet who are trying to faithfully follow Jesus, to love people, to do what is right, who struggle and who, yes, even sin, but who ask for God's grace and forgiveness every single day, well, no one really tells their story. Instead, they're just defined by and judged by the people out on the edges. Gang, the point that I'm trying to make today for anyone who might be concerned about Christians being hypocrites, which I don't take that concern lightly, the study, the people that are watching, but the point that I'm trying to make today for anyone who is concerned about being Christians being hypocrites is this. A Christian who makes a mistake is not necessarily a hypocrite. They're just a human. Are there exceptions to the rule? Have you seen them and met them? I'm sure you have, and that's unfortunate, and I'm sorry for that. Right? But a Christian who makes a mistake is not necessarily a hypocrite. It's probably very likely that they're just a human being. And what that means, and what I wish everyone who is skeptical about Christianity understood, and what I wish maybe even Christians understood themselves is this, that Christians, right? At least the ones that I want you to pay attention to, the one I want you to be, the ones I want you to hang out with and learn from. Christians are not boasting. This is what I want you to know. Christians are not boasting that they are perfect, only that they are forgiven. That's it. Christians are not saying, I'm perfect. They're saying, I'm forgiven. Right? The New Testament writer Paul, he says it like this. He says, so now I'm glad to boast about my weaknesses so that the power of Christ can work through me. Christians are not saying, I'm perfect. I've got all this figured out. Yeah, aren't I amazing? Right? All Christians are saying is, I was lost, but now I'm found. All they're saying is, thank God for his amazing grace that saved a wretch like me. Thank goodness for the power of the cross. Thank goodness for the power of Jesus Christ that could work in me and through me and for me, and that it could overcome all of the weakness and, yes, even all of the imperfection that is sometimes true of me. A Christian's claim to fame is not perfection, it's redemption. It's the grace and the forgiveness that we did not deserve, but that Jesus offered to us anyway. And so that brings me right back to the question that got it all started today. Is hypocrisy among people of faith something to be concerned with? Sure it is. Jesus was concerned with it. I'm just not sure that hypocrisy, as Jesus really defined it, is as fitting a description of the majority of Christians as some maybe believe that it is. And so if you are here today, and you know, Christian or not, but if you are here today and you've been somewhat skeptical about Jesus because of Christians, hear what I would say. Don't judge the many by the few. That's my plea. Don't judge the many by the few. Don't make up your mind about the majority of people who follow Jesus by the minority that don't necessarily represent him all that well. Because the people you see ranting online or that you see in the news are probably not the best representation of Jesus. They're not the ones that most Christians are excited to be associated with. And in that regard, here's maybe what I would say in general about all this. Maybe don't make up your mind about Jesus based on any of us at all. The best person to give you an idea about what Jesus is all about is Jesus himself. So if you're curious, read about his life. Read about his ministry. Read about his teaching in the four books that we refer to as the Gospels in the Bible. Read about his life and his ministry and his teaching in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. If you do not have a Bible, we have one that we will give away to you for free at the welcome desk, right? See for yourself what Jesus was truly all about, and see for yourself the invitation that he makes to you and to me to follow him, because his invitation in many ways was simple. He says, come to me, all who are tired and carrying a heavy, heavy burden, and I'll give you rest. And if that's a Jesus who invites you to follow him to life and to purpose and to rest, right? If that's a Jesus then you can get behind, then I want to give you a chance to recommit yourself to him and to his call on your life today. And so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to close with prayer. And so I'm going to ask that you would, bow your heads with me. And I'm going to close in prayer. And if you are wanting to, in any way, kind of reprioritize Jesus's call on your life today, then pray this short prayer. Silently to yourself, pray this prayer with me. Jesus, I am tired. And I do need the rest that only you can provide. And so today I give you more of my heart, and I commit more of me today to your call on my life. Help me to follow after you more closely in more areas of my life. And now if you've never accepted that invitation from Jesus, never said yes to a relationship with him, to the rest that he wants to offer, but you want to do so today, if you're ready to line up behind the one who has called you to follow him and the one who promised to give you that rest, then pray this prayer with me as well. Jesus, today I say yes to you. Yes to your invitation to me, an invitation to life, an invitation to rest and to following after you and the path that you have laid out for me. Remind me daily of your grace for me and instill in me a confidence of the life that you have called me to. And God, for all of us here, we just want to commit more of ourselves to you, God. A conversation like today does not let us off the hook. God, in many ways, for those of us that follow you, it's a reminder for us to make sure that our hearts are truly positioned toward you in all things, God. Not towards perfection, God. We're not going to be doing this thing following after you. We're not going to be doing it perfectly, God, but we do desire to do it faithfully. And so we're not let off the hook. But God, the call for us is to give more of our lives to you, to follow faithfully after you, to care about the things that you care about, to love the people that you love, and to live the life that you have called us to. And we ask for your help in doing that. And we pray these things in the name of your son, Jesus. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this week's message from Midcurrent Church. For more information and to visit us online, check out midcurrentchurch.org and follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Midcurrent Church is located at 200 First Street in downtown Hudson, Wisconsin. Be sure to join us on Sunday mornings, both online and in person at 9 and 10:30 a.m.